Have the grace to say so now, if you think your courage might fail. If we lose another trial, we can kiss goodbye to our livelihoods, and all our work will be for nothing. You see, he couldn't resist it, the chance to put me right. He will never let it drop, what I did as a boy. He uses me to make his sermon on. Well, let him make his next sermon on the block. The evening before Fisher is to die, he visits Moore. He takes a strong guard with him, but he leaves them in the outer chamber and goes in alone. "I've got used to the blind drawn," Moore says, almost cheerfully. "You don't mind sitting in the twilight?" "You need not be afraid of the sun. There is none. Wolsey used to boast that he could change the weather." He chuckles. "It's good of you to visit me, Thomas, now that we have no more to say. Or have we?" "The guards will come for Bishop Fisher early tomorrow. I am afraid they will wake you. I should be a poor Christian if I could not keep vigil with him." His smile has seeped away. "I hear the king has granted him mercy as to the manner of his death. He being a very old man and frail." Moore says with tart pleasantness, "I'm doing my best, you know. A man can only shrivel at his own rate. Listen." He reaches across the table, takes his hand, wrings it, harder than he meant. "My blacksmith's grip," he thinks. He sees Moore flinch, feels his fingers, the skin dry as paper over the bones. "Listen. When you come before the court, throw yourself at that instant on the king's mercy." Moore says, wonderingly, "What good will that do me?" "He is not a cruel man, you know that."
"Do I?" "He used not to be. He had a sweet disposition, but then he changed the company he kept."
"He is susceptible always to a plea for mercy. I do not say he will let you live, the oath unsworn, but he may grant you the same mercy as Fisher."
"It's not so important what happens to the body. I have led in some ways a blessed life. God has been good and not tested me. Now he does, I cannot fail him. I have been vigilant over my heart, and I have not always liked what I have found there. If it comes into the hands of the hangman at the last, so be it. It will be in God's hands soon enough."
"Will you think me sentimental if I say I do not want to see you butchered?" No reply. "Are you not afraid of the pain?"
"Oh, yes, I am very much afraid. I'm not a bold and robust man such as yourself. I cannot help but rehearse it in my mind. But I will only feel it for a moment, and God will not let me remember it afterwards."
"I'm glad I'm not like you."
"Undoubtedly, or you would be sitting here.
I mean, my mind fixed on the next world. I realize you see no prospect of improving this one."
"And you do?"
Almost a flippant question. A handful of hail smacks itself against the window. It startles them both. He gets up, restless. He would rather know what's outside, see the summer in its sad blowing wreckage, then cower behind the blind and wonder what the damage is. "I once had every hope," he says. "The world corrupts me, I think. Or perhaps it's just the weather. It pulls me down and makes me think like you, that one should shrink inside, down and down to a little point of light, preserving one's solitary soul like a flame under a glass. The spectacles of pain and disgrace I see around me, the ignorance, the unthinking vice, the poverty and the lack of hope, and oh, the rain. The rain that falls on England and rots the grain, puts out the light in a man's eye, and the light of learning, too. For who can reason if Oxford is a giant puddle, and Cambridge is washing away downstream? And who will enforce the laws if the judges are swimming for their lives? Last week the people were rioting in York. Why would they not? With wheat so scarce, and twice the price of last year. I must stir up the justices to make examples, I suppose.
Otherwise the whole of the North will be out with billhooks and pikes. And who will they slaughter but each other? I truly believe I should be a better man if the weather were better. I should be a better man if I lived in a commonwealth where the sun shone and the citizens were rich and free. If only that were true, Master Moore. You wouldn't have to pray for me nearly as hard as you do.
How you can talk, Moore says. Words, words, just words. I do, of course, pray for you. I pray with all my heart that you will see that you are misled. When we meet in heaven, as I hope we will, all our differences will be forgot. But for now, we cannot wish them away. Your task is to kill me. Mine is to keep alive. It is my role and my duty. All I own is the ground I stand on, and that ground is Thomas Moore. If you want it, you will have to take it from me. You cannot reasonably believe I will yield it. You will want pen and paper to write out your defense. I will grant you that. You never give up trying, do you? No, Master Secretary. My defense is up here. He taps his forehead, where it will stay safe from you. How strange the room is. How empty without Moore's books. It is filling with shadows. Martin, a candle, he calls. Will you be here tomorrow for the bishop? He nods, though he will not witness the moment of Fisher's death. The protocol is that the spectators bow their knee and doff their hats to mark the passing of the soul. Martin brings a Prickett candle. Anything else? They pause while he sets it down. When he is gone, they still pause. The prisoner sits hunched over, looking into the flame. How does he know if Moore has begun on a silence, or on preparation for speech? There is a silence which precedes speech. There is a silence which is instead of speech. One need not break it with a statement. One can break it with a hesitation. If, as it may be, if it were possible. He says, I would have left you, you know, to live out your life, to repent of your butcheries, if I were king. The light fades. It is as if the prisoner has withdrawn himself from the room, leaving barely a shape where he should be. A draught pulls at the candle flame. The bare table between them, clear now of Moore's driven scribblings, has taken on the aspect of an altar. And what is an altar for but a sacrifice? Moore breaks his silence at last. If, at the end and after I am tried, if the king does not grant, if the full rigour of the penalty. Thomas, how is it done? You would think when a man's belly was slashed open he would die, with a great effusion of blood. But it seems it is not so. Do they have some special implement that they use to pith him while he is alive? I am sorry you should think me expert. But had he not told Norfolk, as good as told him, that he had pulled out a man's heart? He says, it is the executioner's mystery. It is kept secret, to keep us in awe. Let me be killed cleanly. I ask nothing, but I ask that. Swaying on his stool, he is seized between one heartbeat and the next, in the grip of bodily agitation. He cries out, shudders from head to foot. His hand beats weakly at the clean tabletop, and when he leaves him, Martin, go in, give him some wine. He is still crying out, shuddering, beating the table. The next time he sees him will be in Westminster Hall. On the day of the trial, rivers breach their banks. The Thames itself rises, bubbling like some river in hell, and washes its flotsam over the quays. It's England against Rome, he says, the living against the dead. Norfolk will preside.
He tells him how it will be. The early counts in the indictment will be thrown out. They concern sundry words spoken at sundry times, about the act and the oath, and Moore's treasonable conspiracy with Fisher. Letters went between the two of them, but it seems those letters are now destroyed. Then, on the fourth count, we will hear the evidence of the Solicitor General. Now, Your Grace, this will divert Moore, because he cannot see young Rich without working himself into a fit about his derelictions when he was a boy. The Duke raises an eyebrow. Drinking, fighting, women, dice. Norfolk rubs his bristly chin.
I have noticed a soft-looking lad like that. He always does fight. To make a point, you see. Whereas we damn slab-faced old bruisers who are born with our armour on, there's no point we need to make.
Quite, he says. We are the most pacific of men. My lord, please attend now. We don't want another mistake like Dacre. We would hardly survive it. The early counts will be thrown out. At the next, the jury will look alert. And I have given you a handsome jury. Moore will face his peers, Londoners, the merchants of the livery companies. They are experienced men with all the city's prejudices. They have seen enough, as all Londoners have, of the church's rapacity and arrogance, and they do not take kindly to being told they are unfit to read the scriptures in their own tongue. They are men who know Moore, and have known him these 20 years. They know how he widowed Lucy Pettit. They know how he wrecked Humphrey Monmouth's business, because Tyndale had been a guest at his house. They know how he has set spies in their households, among their apprentices whom they treat as sons, among the servants so familiar and homely that they hear every night their master's bedside prayers. One name makes Audley hesitate.
John Parnell? It might be taken wrong. You know he has been after Moore since he gave judgment against him in Chancery.
I know the case. Moore botched it. He didn't read the papers. Too busy writing a billet doux to Erasmus. Or locking some poor Christian soul in his stocks at Chelsea. What do you want, Audley?
Do you want me to go to Wales for a jury? Or up to Cumberland? Or somewhere they think better of Moore?
I must make do with London men, and unless I swear in a jury of newborns, I cannot wipe their memories clear. Audley shakes his head.
I don't know Cromwell.
Oh, he's a sharp fellow, the Duke says. When Wolsey came down, I said, mark him, he's a sharp fellow. You'd have to get up early in the morning to be ahead of him.
The night before the trial, as he is going through his papers at the Austin Friars, a head appears around the door. A little narrow London head with a close-shaved skull and a raw young face. Dick Purser. Come in. Dick Purser looks around the room. He keeps the snarling band-dogs who guard the house by night, and he has not been in here before. Come here and sit. Don't be afraid. He pours him some wine into a thin Venetian glass that was the Cardinal's.
Try this. Wiltshire sent it to me. I don't make much of it myself.
Dick takes the glass and juggles it dangerously. The liquid is pale as straw or summer light. He takes a gulp.
Sir, can I come in your train to the trial?
It still smarts, does it? Dick Purser was the boy whom Moore had whipped before the household at Chelsea for saying the host was a piece of bread. He was a child then. He's not much more now. When he first came to Austin Friars, they say he cried in his sleep.
Get yourself a livery coat, he says, and remember to wash your hands and face in the morning. I don't want you to disgrace me.
It is the word disgrace that works on the child.
I hardly mind the pain, he says. We have all had, saving you, sir, as much, if not worse, from our fathers.
True. He says, my father beat me as if I were a sheet of metal.
It was that he laid my flesh bare, and the women looking on, Dame Alice,
the young girls. I thought one of them might speak up for me, but when they saw me unbreached, I only disgusted them. It made them laugh. While the fellow was whipping me, they were laughing. In stories, it is always the young girls, innocent girls, who stay the hand of the man with the rod or the axe. But we seem to have strayed into a different story. A child's thin buttocks dimpling against the cold, his skinny little balls, his shy pricks shrinking to a button, while the ladies of the house giggle, and the men-servants jeer, and the thin wheels spring out against his skin and bleed. It's done and forgotten now. Don't cry. He comes from behind his desk. Dick Purser drops his shorn head against his shoulder and bawls in shame, in relief, in triumph that soon he will have outlived his tormentor. More did John Purser to death. He harassed him for owning German books. He holds the boy, feeling the jump of his pulses, his stiff sinews, the ropes of his muscles, and makes sounds of comfort, as he did to his children when they were small, or as he does to a spaniel whose tail has been trodden on. Comfort is often, he finds, imparted at the cost of a flea or two. "I will follow you to the death," the boy declares. His arms, fists clenched, grip his master. Knuckles knead his spine. He sniffs. "I think I will look well in a livery coat. What time do we start?" Early. With his staff, he is at Westminster Hall before anybody else, vigilant for last-minute hitches. The court convenes around him, and when Moore is brought in, the hall is visibly shocked at his appearance. The Tower was never known to do a man good, but he startles them with his lean person and his ragged white beard, looking more like a man of 70 than what he is. Audley whispers, "He looks as if he has been badly handled." And he says, "I never miss a trick." "Well, my conscience is clear," the Lord Chancellor says breezily. "He has had every consideration." John Parnell gives him a nod. Richard Rich, both court official and witness, gives him a smile. Audley asks for a seat for the prisoner, but Moore twitches to the edge of it, keyed up, combative. He glances around to check that someone is taking notes for him. Words, words, just words. He thinks, "I remembered you, Thomas Moore, but you didn't remember me. You never even saw me coming." Chapter 3. To Wolf Hall. July 1535. On the evening of Moore's death, the weather clears, and he walks in the garden with Rafe and Richard. The sun shows itself, a silver haze between rags of cloud. The beaten-down herb beds are scentless, and a skittish wind pulls at their clothes, hitting the backs of their necks and then veering round to slap their faces. Rafe says, "It's like being at sea." They walk at either side of him, and close, as if there were danger from whales, pirates and mermaids. It is 5 days since the trial. Since then, much business has supervened, but they cannot help rehearse its events, trading with each other the pictures in their heads. The Attorney General, jotting a last note in the indictment, Moore sniggering when some clerk made the slip in his Latin, the cold, smooth faces of the Boleyns, father and son, on the judge's bench. Moore had never raised his voice. He sat in the chair Audley had provided for him, attentive, head tipped a little to the left, picking away at his sleeve. So Richard's surprise, when Moore turned on him, was visible. He had taken a step backwards, and steadied himself against the table. "I know you of old, Rich. Why would I open my mind to you?" Moore, on his feet, his voice dripping contempt. "I have known you since your youth, a gamer and a dicer, of no commendable fame even in your own house."
"By St. Julian!"
Josephus James had exclaimed. It was ever his oath. Under his breath to him, Cromwell says, "Will he gain by this?" The jury had not liked it. You never know what a jury will like. They took more sudden animation to be shock and guilt at being confronted with his own words. For sure, they all knew Richard's reputation. But are not drinking, dice and fighting more natural in a young man on the whole than fasting, beads and self-flagellation? It was Norfolk who had cut in on Moore's tirade, his voice dry.
"Leave aside the man's character. What do you say to the matter in hand? Did you speak those words?"
Was it then that Master Moore played a trick too many? He had pulled himself together, hauling his slipping gown onto his shoulder. The gown secured, he paused, he calmed himself, he fitted one fist into the other.
"I did not say what Rich alleges, or if I did say it, I did not mean it with malice, therefore I am clear under the statute."
He had watched an expression of derision cross Parnell's face. There's nothing harder than a London burgess who thinks he's been played for a fool. Audley, or any of the lawyers, could have put the jury right. It's just how we lawyers argue. But they don't want a lawyer's argument, they want the truth. Did you say it, or didn't you? George Boleyn leans forward. Can the prisoner let us have his own version of the conversation? Moore turns, smiling, as if to say, "A good point there, young Master George."
"I made no note of it. I had no writing materials, you see. They had already taken them away, for if you remember, my Lord Rochford, that was the very reason Rich came to me, to remove from me the means of recording."
And he had paused again, and looked at the jury as if expecting applause. They looked back, faces like stones. Was that the turning point? They might have trusted Moore, being, as he was, Lord Chancellor at one time, and Perse, as everybody knows, such a waster. You never know what a jury will think, though when he had convened them, of course he had been persuasive. He had spoken with them that morning. I do not know what his defence is, but I don't hold out hope we will be finished by noon. I hope you all had a good breakfast. When you retire, you must take your time, of course. But if you are gone more than 20 minutes by my reckoning, I will come in to see how you do, to put you out of doubt on any points of law. 15 minutes was all they needed. Now, this evening in the garden, July 6th, the feast day of St. Godelva, a blameless young wife of Bruges, whose evil husband drowned her in a pond. He looks up at the sky, feeling a change in the air, a damp drift like autumn. The interlude of feeble sun is over. Clouds drift and mass in towers and battlements, blowing in from Essex, stacking up over the city, driven by the wind across the broad, soaked fields, across the sodden pasture land and swollen rivers, across the dripping forests of the west, and out over the sea to Ireland. Richard retrieves his hat from a lavender bed, and knocks droplets from it, swearing softly. A spatter of rain hits their faces.
"Time to go in. I have letters to write."
"You'll not work till all hours tonight?"
"No, Grandfather Rafe. I shall get my bread and milk and say my Ave, and so to bed. Can I take my dog up with me?"
"Indeed, no. And have you scampering overhead till all hours?" It's true he didn't sleep much last night. It had come to him, the wrong side of midnight, that Moore was no doubt asleep himself, not knowing that it was his last night on earth. It is not usual, till the morning, to prepare the condemned man. So he had thought, "Any vigil I keep for him, I keep alone." They hurry in. The wind bangs the door behind them. Rafe takes his arm. He says, "This silence of Moore's, it was never really silence, was it? It was loud with his treason. It was quibbling as far as quibbles would serve him. It was demurs and cavils, suave ambiguities. It was fear of plain words, or the assertion that plain words pervert themselves. Moore's dictionary against our dictionary. You can have a silence full of words. A lute retains in its bowl the notes it has played. The viol in its strings holds a concord. A shriveled petal can hold its scent. A prayer can rattle with curses. An empty house, when the owners have gone out, can still be loud with ghosts. Someone, probably not Christoph, has put on his desk a shining silver pot of cornflowers. The dusky blueness at the base of the crinkled petals reminds him of this morning's light. A late dawn for July, a sullen sky. By 5, the lieutenant of the tower would have gone into Moore. Down below, he can hear a stream of messengers coming into the courtyard. There is much to do, tidying up after the dead man. After all, he thinks, I did it when I was a child, picking up after Morton's young gentleman, and this is the last time I will have to do it. He pictures himself in the dawn, slopping into a leather jug the dregs of small beer, squeezing up the candle ends to take to the chandlery for remelting. He can hear voices in the hall. Never mind them. He returns to his letters. The Abbot of Rewley solicits a vacant post for his friend. The Mayor of York writes to him about weirs and fish traps. The Humber is running clean and sweet, he reads. So is the Ouse. A letter from Lord Lyle in Calais, relating some muddled tale of self-justification. He said, then I said, so he said. Thomas Moore stands before him, more solid in death than he was in life. Perhaps he will always be here now, so agile of mind and so adamant, as he appeared in his final hour before the court. Audley was so happy with the guilty verdict that he began to pass sentence without asking the prisoner if he had anything to say. Fitzjames had to reach out and slap his arm, and Moore himself rose from his chair to halt him. He had much to say, and his voice was lively, his tone biting, and his eyes, his gestures, hardly those of a condemned man, in law already dead. There was nothing new in it. Not new, anyway, to him. I follow my conscience, Moore said. You must follow yours. My conscience satisfies me, and now I will speak plainly that your statute is faulty, and Norfolk roars at him, and that your authority baseless. Norfolk roars again. Now we see your malice plain. Parnell had laughed, and the jury exchanged glances, nodding to each other. And while the whole of Westminster Hall murmured, Moore proffered again, speaking against the noise, his treasonable method of counting. My conscience holds with the majority, which makes me know it does not speak false. Against Henry's kingdom I have all the kingdoms of Christendom. Against each one of your bishops I have 100 saints. Against your one parliament I have all the general councils of the church, stretching back for 1,000 years. Norfolk said, take him out, it is finished. Now it is Tuesday, it is 8 o'clock. The rain drums against the window. He breaks the seal of a letter from the Duke of Richmond. The boy complains that in Yorkshire, where he is seated, he has no deer park, so can show his friends no sport. Oh, you poor tiny duke, he thinks, how can I relieve your pain? Gregory's dowager, with the black teeth, the one he is going to marry, she has a deer park, so perhaps the princeling should divorce Norfolk's daughter and marry her instead. He flips aside Richmond's letter, tempted to file it on the floor. He passes on. The Emperor has left Sardinia with his fleet, sailing to Sicily. A priest at St. Mary Woolchurch says Cromwell is a sectary, and he is not frightened of him. Fool. Harry, Lord Morley, sends him a greyhound. There is news of refugees pouring out of the Munster area, some of them heading for England. Audley had said, Prisoner, the court will ask the king to make grace upon you as to the manner of your death. Audley had leaned across. Master Secretary, did you promise him anything? On my life, no. But surely the King will be good to him. Norfolk says, Cromwell, will you move him in that regard? He will take it from you. But if he will not, I myself will come and plead with him. What a marvel! Norfolk asking for mercy.